1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train. And today, in the studio, it's the talented quintet who helped define the sound of the 80s as rock ambassadors from New Jersey. Oh, 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 shake it up.
What I didn't get out of that experience was the pure pleasure of it. And a lot of that had to do with a lot of good people trying to get me to do a job, but not having the foresight to see that these kids were going to get exhausted and burned out and not enjoy it. And if it's between a steroid shot or another drink or your parents looking to you as the parents or the people who are sucking up to you because of your notoriety or for your money, it changed everyone around us even more than it changed us.
I didn't buy into it, yeah, because I knew that it could be gone tomorrow. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I mean, let me tell you something. I had a really good time, and I thank God every day for what I did. And I said, damn, this is a good job. You know, I mean, this is good work if you can get it. But I knew that quite possibly it was not going to be there tomorrow.
Hi, this is John Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora.
And you are in the studio for the anniversary celebration
of Bon Jovi's New Jersey.
From August 1986 until the fall of 88, five guys from New Jersey sold 9 million copies of their third album, called Slippery When Wet. Bon Jovi's tireless touring, good hooks, and good looks had paid off big in the rock and roll lottery, but inevitably a follow-up was due from David Bryan, Tico Torres, Alex Such, Richie Sambora, and John Bon Jovi. Expectations were high, both outside and inside the core of the band, but ambitions were equal to the task of taking Bon Jovi's all-American appeal to a world audience. I talked with lead singer John Bon Jovi about the Roman candle of fame and the pressure to repeat Slippery When Wet's phenomenal sales.
We knew that we had to make a great album that we would enjoy playing now, you know, because from now on I have to, like, look forward to doing this, you know. And when things like Blood on Blood appeared and that kind of, you know, we knew that we were on the right track. There was the fear factor, not having the success again in monetary values reasons, okay? I'll tell you the two extremes. One at the Budokan in Japan, just before the album came out, but we were confident because we had been big there since 84, that we could do the Budokan without a new album, which was absolutely the wrong thing to take for granted. We got to Japan, the Budokan was about half sold out, and I was losing my mind. I'll do anything to get kids in the arena, you know, all the press I need to do, any radio that'll take me, TV shows, anything. We ended up doing about 3/4 of a house, and probably that was one of our best shows ever because we played our hearts out. You know, like we said, basically, we would do this for free if there was a full house so that you can grow old and say, hey, the famous Tokyo Budokan, you know, where everyone's played, we sold it out. Well, we didn't, and you knew not to take it for granted. Then on the other end of the spectrum, we did Castle Donington, and there's 70,000 plus kids out there, and I say, how you doing? And like the whole crowd went, we're good, and I'm thinking, my God, those 70,000 people just said, you know, they're fine. Like it was an intimate conversation, you know? And you realize that you'd give up anything just to be able to do that again. And that was what I wanted with this album.
Lay your hands on me, lay your hands on me, lay your hands on me. 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 Come on! Your lady, I'm willing and able. Help me lay my cards out on the table. You're mine and I'm yours for the taking. I'm not alone.
Lay Your Hands on Me was a way for me to express the feeling that we're still very accessible. I think that one thing that we've pride ourselves on is even in an opening act situation or a club act or wherever we happen to be, we were accessible. We were able to be one-on-one with our audience if it was 50 or 50,000. I like to think that we still have that. And not to think that we're any different, you know? I mean, one of the things that we said, we were almost thinking about calling the album is we're the same old dudes in new shoes, you know?
I like that.
Because we think of ourselves like that. And to say, lay your hands on me, you know, if you want me to lay my hands on you, lay your hands on me. And that's really how, you know, the lyric goes. Because it's going to open the show, and that's how we want to start the night. Let's get all the stuff, the pretense out of the way. We're the same old guys we used to be, you know?
Sure, that was true, but Slippery When Wet's 17 million copies sold to date changed virtually everything else. One of the knocks on the 80s hair bands, of which Bon Jovi was lumped back then, was that some of those hair bands posed better than they actually played. Here's lead guitarist and co-writer Richie Sambora in the studio.
I'm a self-taught musician. I taught myself how to play guitar. And it's a strange thing when you teach yourself. Every day, if you want to get better, you can't say, oh, well, I can do this and rest on that. You can say, what can I do and how am I going to approach getting better at it? So it's a constant grounding. And I think I take that through the rest of my life as far as how I evolve as a person and as a musician, as anything. You know, you have to, if you want to get better at something, what you got to see is what you can't do first. So you're always looking at the downsides to the upside. So that's a really reality-based hard line. To me, the foundation of any good record is a song. Foundation of our whole music business, anything that we do, is a song. And if somebody says to me, hey, Rich, you know, what do you think a good song is? I says, well, it's something that hits you in the heart, something that conjures up some kind of sentimental feeling, a sentimental snapshot of a time in your life, or maybe now, or something that you can say, hey, I felt like that. You know, pop music is very, very, very underestimated in today's society. Musicians and popular music is very underestimated. It's a very healing force, and it accompanies you through your life, through the good times, the bad times. I mean, you remember what you were listening to when you were in the backseat with your girlfriend the first time. You remember when she broke your heart, what you went home and you put on. You know I used to go home and put on blues all the time when that happens, but at least I didn't feel alone. You know, so it really keeps people company. I think as a writer, I tend to write human songs. I tend to write stuff that I maybe went through in my life. There's a bunch of different ways that I can write music, from what's happening now in my life and how I feel. I have a very acute emotional memory, which means I'm very, very vulnerable to pulling out different feelings from my past. They're very clear. And my factual memory, due to the late 80s, ain't as good as I would like it to be. But my emotional memory is quite intact. So that tends me to be able to write about different situations when I grew up and maybe someone broke my heart, or I can pull that stuff out pretty easily.
I got a fever, got a pulling into season. It'll take more than a day.
single release from Bon Jovi's New Jersey album called Bad Medicine went immediately to number one on the chart by November 1988. Up next, John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora reveal how a hit movie inspired them to write the song Blood on Blood. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and check out a whole lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora for the 30th anniversary of their multi-million-selling 1988 album, New Jersey.
Hi, this is John Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora.
And you are in the studio for the anniversary celebration
of Bon Jovi's New Jersey.
Thanks, guys. I'm Redbeard. The Garden State has been fertile musical ground for decades, from Frank Sinatra to Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, from Bruce Springsteen to Southside Johnny. So it's only fitting that John Bon Jovi, along with song Dr. Desmond Child and Richie Sambora, could write a chorus worthy of these Jersey greats. Here's John Bon Jovi with me in the studio.
We were capable as players. We became more capable as writers. To get a little more funky. We certainly weren't the blockhead kind of band that knew three chords. We knew how to play our instruments. My drummer is a very funky drummer. My bass player is a very funky bass player. And they can play. I remember sitting down with Prince very early, you know, in that era, and going, wow, man, I can't believe you've got my record. You know, he goes, what's the matter? Black man can't own a TV set? Yeah, I saw this stuff on TV. And then, you know, and then he showed up at our show like wearing a Bon Jovi shirt. And he goes, you guys is more funky than Aerosmith. And I took that as a huge compliment coming from somebody I looked up to so much. But, you know, everybody was watching what everyone else was doing too. Trust me, we were looking to what Mutt Lang did with Def Leppard, with Pyromania, and then they looked to Slippery for its rawness, and then whatever their next record was, we looked back to, which was what, Hysteria, and then they were looking at us when we did New Jersey, and then all those bands that started coming into the Little Mountain were chasing that thing too, you know, and there was AC/DC went up to see Bruce, and Aerosmith went up to see Bruce, and Van Halen went to see Bruce, and they all came to our studio, and they all went with the same combination of everyone that we had already done. But it was just that magic moment. And as much as I'd love to pat myself on the back, every one of those bands I mentioned, I was greatly influenced by. So, you know, it's nothing more than just a circle of influence.
Something they can't take away. Our love, our life.
As Bon Jovi's New Jersey album sold millions while the band launched another worldwide tour, world-changing calls for freedom and justice were being raised in places such as South Africa, Ethiopia, and the communist bloc countries of Eastern Europe, including Germany's Berlin Wall. Superstar popularity brought a new scrutiny by some rock critics to Bon Jovi's lighthearted cars and guitars themes back then. Here's John Bon Jovi.
No one cared in the first two records. It was with the third one, and I think it took so many people by surprise that they couldn't be as cruel as they wanted to be, because it was just such a phenomenon. It wasn't until the fourth album, New Jersey, that I thought that the fingers were pointing at us. You know, I think it is people music. It's folk music. That like that old commercial said, it's music for folks. It doesn't make it any better, but it certainly doesn't make it any worse than the most critically acclaimed, you know, band that there might be out there. And I'm a huge fan of a lot of those kinds of bands, but there's a place for all of it. And anyone who plays music or anyone who's ever really listened to appreciate music knows that the magic that music brings, I think it's such an influence on all the other art forms, be it painting or writing a book or a play or a screenplay or, you know, I just really believe that it has influence on obviously dance and on theater as well. So music to me is the heartbeat of what makes people move emotionally. And I've been on the receiving and on the giving end of that.
A popular coming-of-age film, based on the story written by Stephen King, starring Kiefer Sutherland and the late River Phoenix, inspired John Bon Jovi, Richie Sambora, and songwriter Desmond Child to compose the tune Blood on Blood.
Well, I got the idea watching the movie Stand By Me. I was sitting in a hotel room watching it, and it really blew me away. And I think that everybody that's seen that movie can relate, you know, to being 13 and having your buddies that you swore were your buddies forever. These are the kids that, you know, you did everything with. You drank your first beer, smoked your first cigarette, and kissed your first girl or what have you. And these two guys that I hung out with, we stole leather jackets off a train, and, you know, we used to, like, sneak money out to buy beer and got in trouble together. And you thought that these were your friends for life, you know? But what happened is we all grew apart as time went on, and they both joined the Navy, and the gang sort of broke up, you know? I mean, a lot of tough things happened for the three of us. So there was a lot of growing up, you know, and we all went our separate ways. And we even started playing instruments together. We'd like sort of lip sync to, I remember, God, like to Beatles music and old Aerosmith stuff in this kid's house. And the drummer could sort of play drums. The bass player at least owned an amp and a beat up bass. I would sing, and this Danny would try to play guitar, but man, we couldn't do it. So we were sort of jumping around the room to a tape, you know. I never forgot it. We were going to call it Band Stars, and all of a sudden that Band Stars came out, you know. It's like, well, we need a new name, you know. And you know, you just, I remember those times. You never thought that they would change, you know, that anything would happen. Well, Danny and Bobby went on to join the Navy, and I was still playing in bands. And then I hadn't seen them for years and years. And having seen that movie, I started thinking about them again and wrote down this idea for a song. And the scratch title was called Stand By Me. And I was writing it. When I came home, I told Rich about this title, Blood on Blood, that I wanted to use. And I had this song that I'd written in the room that day. And did he want to be involved in it? And he said, sure. You know, we sat down, and then Dez came over and he heard what we had done, and he threw in his 2 cents on that one as well. And I guess if there's two songs I could be wanted to be remembered for, it would be that and Wanted That Are Alive, you know. I think Blood on Blood is one of the best songs we've ever written, yeah.
Blood Brothers from A More Innocent Time. That's Jon Bon Jovi with Blood on Blood from the 1988 album New Jersey. Up next, sobering revelations from Jon Bon Jovi on the high physical and psychological toll of superstardom. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can get a whole lot more here at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Jon Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora for the 30th anniversary of their multi-million selling 1988 album, New Jersey.
Hi, this is Jon Bon Jovi of Bon Jovi.
Hi, this is Richie Sambora.
And you are in the studio for the anniversary celebration
of Bon Jovi's New Jersey.
Thanks, guys. I'm Redbeard. The only other band that rivaled Bon Jovi for this level of popularity was U2. Jon Bon Jovi told me about bumping into Bono in Ireland.
In the fall of 88, I remember being in Dublin on the road with New Jersey. So a year later, not only had we written and recorded, but we were back on the road again. And in Ireland, in Dublin, and a wise man asked me such a deep question by simply saying, "What are you doing here?" And goodness gracious, I wish I was smart then as I am now, because God knows I should have got up and said, "You're right. I'm going home. I'm going to bed." But we did another 240 show tour, and that whole kind of, "I'll show you. I'll prove to the world. I'm going to write 5 more number one songs. I'm going to do." In retrospect, it was a big mistake. But that's what life was. You know, that's what we wanted to do. And that's how that chip on the shoulder came. And that's how, you know, we were going to differentiate ourselves from everyone else. This is how, but that was a trying time.
Where was that drive coming from? Was it internally? Were you driving yourself in the band? Or was it externally for people that were prepared to eat the golden goose?
You know, when I at first, if you had asked me this question in 91, 92, I would have finger pointed. And I would have said, "Ugh, the ignorance of these morons who were just there to suck your blood and take your money." The truth of the matter is they were all actually quite good people who were just trying to do their job. But they weren't as experienced as they should have been to be in that fatherly, motherly, big brotherly kind of position. Because if I were a manager now looking to a band who runs themselves into the ground, and regardless of people wanting that record or the agents wanting them to tour, the demand of the promoters, I would be the guy that says, "Forget it. It'll come out when it's ready. It'll come out when they're ready. And until then, the world can wait." And you have to have had that confidence to tell the kids that you're working with, "The world can wait." Very few guys do that. Now, that took, you know, me as the, you know, 24 years later to be talking to you like that. But at the time, I didn't know better. And it was definitely me that was, had, you know, throwing his hand up in the air saying, "Ah, come on, give me the shot. I can deal with this. Let's go." Not knowing that I was just burning out one cell at a time and not enjoying it. And that's a shame. I mean, to be able to get to that pinnacle and not enjoy every last moment of it, oof, that's tough, because had it not ever happened again, that would have been a sin.
I guess this time you're really cried a 1,000 rivers.
Terrific chorus on Bon Jovi's September 1988 single, I'll Be There For You, which, upon its release, debuted at number one. Both Bad Medicine and later I'll Be There For You also went to the top of the singles chart, with three others going top 10, resulting in the New Jersey album setting the record for the most top 10 hits from a hard rock album with five. No other hard rock album has equaled or broken that record in 25 years.
You know, I'd like to think that I've made a lot of friends through the years, you know, and those friends you stay loyal to and they stay loyal to you. You know what I mean? That those are the things that you try to keep your feet on the ground and always keep your sneakers dirty.
Good line.
But it's pretty neat because, you know, I can go down to, you know, Krauser's and buy milk, or, you know what I mean? You go out every day and you do your thing. That's just the way it is, you know? The day I lose that, I'm in trouble.
Contrast that 25-year-old John Bon Jovi naively entering the arena and this 25-year wizened veteran of the lion's den of superstardom.
But, you know, it's interesting because I hear that for the first time, obviously, years later. And I don't disagree with what it is that I said. I've obviously grown and grown up in public, and so, you know, my thoughts and views have changed and become deeper, but that just becomes, you know, you're talking to a man instead of a boy. But what I didn't get out of that experience was the pure pleasure of it. And a lot of that had to do with a lot of good people trying to get me to do a job, but not having the foresight to see that these kids were going to get exhausted and burned out and not enjoy it. And if it's between a steroid shot or another drink or your parents looking to you as the parents or the people who are sucking up to you because of your notoriety or for your money, it changed everyone around us even more than it changed us. If you ask Richie or the guys, their experience will have been much different than mine. It isn't the most fond period of my career for me. It's one that I don't really look back on as fondly as you would imagine I do. Because I don't. I learned with time to enjoy it, and I learned to enjoy it on my own terms. And now I can say that I've mastered that. But looking back, I can't tell you that it was the fondest of memories, no.
And then standing a mere 10 feet outside the spotlight on 1,000 stadium concerts, and later marrying and divorcing actress Heather Locklear, Richie Sambora's had a ringside seat to John Bon Jovi's fishbowl life of celebrity.
I didn't buy into it, yeah, because I knew that it could be gone tomorrow. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I mean, let me tell you something. I had a really good time, and I thank God every day for what I did. And I said, damn, this is a good job. You know, I mean, this is good work if you can get it. But I knew that quite possibly it was not going to be there tomorrow, you know, and, you know, I think that attitude is probably testimony to my longevity at this point in this business and how I approach that by not taking it for granted and continuing to work real hard.
I'm gonna see those senoritas lying under the sun.
when we wrote Born to Be My Baby, it's funny, we were sitting around, it was actually the three of us, Desmond was with us, and Richard walked into the room and I was playing this chord progression of the chorus and picking at it, and he's, you know, I've got this title, Born to Be My Baby. And it was funny because it was just like the day we wrote Living on a Prayer, everybody's eyes went, oh, that's it, you know? And then I start singing, Born to Be My Baby. And I'm going, Made to Be Your Man. And everybody, we just knew it was there. And it was like, this is it, you know? Get your pens, you know? It really came together. That song is a lot of fun. It was more Jersey in the demo version when I was playing a lot of harp in it. I was playing a lot of harmonica, and it was vetoed. 4-1 vote, I lost. But it was really neat because it was a little Dylan-esque at the time, and which was pretty cool.
Reading at and we worked all day. We got jobs cause there's bills to pay. We got something that can't take away. Close the door, you leave the cold outside. You need nothing, baby, by your side. We got something that'll never die. Our dreams are bright. Our beats like a drum. Oh, no. Flesh to flesh, one to one. All right. I'll never let go, cause there's something I know deep inside. TV tray. It ain't fancy, baby, that's okay. Our time, our way. Hold me close, baby, hang on tight. Got a buckle of your seat for this bumpy ride. With two kids hitching down the road alive. Our world, our fight. So stand by my side. There's a chance that we can get by. And I know that it should be forever, till the day that I die. You were born to be my baby. Really, I was made to be your man. We got something to believe in, even if we're torn. Yeah.
original Born to Be My Baby demo version from Bon Jovi on the 30th anniversary of the album New Jersey. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.